Hey, welcome back to another episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcefy and ISBA. I'm one of your hosts, Nathan Resnick, joined by...
And I'm Aaron Allpeter. Here on E-commerce on Tap, we take a well-known venture-backed company, tell their founding story, and then reverse engineer their supply chain. So it's been a lot of fun. Nathan, what caught your attention this week?
Yeah, so this week, I think two things really caught my eye. Number one is just this continued growth in creator-led brands. So I saw Sophia Richie partner with a self-tanning company, Sol de Janeiros, and launch like her own line of self-tanner. And I'm just kind of curious, like if I'm Sophia Richie, you know, I'm pretty famous. I've got 11 plus million followers on Instagram, you know, millions and more on TikTok. Like, why not go out and create my own self-tanner brand? And I'm just was kind of surprised that she partnered with, you know, a big sunscreen slash self-tanner brand like this. I think, you know, they probably offered her a really good deal. But at the same time, I think more and more creators are realizing they can build more value by building their own brands. And there's already been so many success stories around this. But I'm just kind of curious, like, what that deal actually looked like behind the scenes. Because for someone as big as Sophia Richie, to me, it seems like she should have just gone out and created her own self-tanning brand instead of doing this partnership.
I wonder who approached who. Do you think that there's a, like, what's the critical mass? How many different types of creator-led brands do you think we can add out there?
I mean, I think it's going to continue. I mean, I think, you know, really, if you have a loyal, engaged audience, it doesn't necessarily matter the size. It just matters about the engagement, right? I mean, you know, one of my favorite stories in this niche is Epic Gardening. You know, he now runs Kevin. Kevin's the, you know, leading gardening audience in America. He runs a multi 8-figure gardening business, and it all started from his blog, epicgardening.com. So it seems like a very small niche, but it is a, you know, sizable e-commerce brand that is primarily led through his blog and YouTube channel and social media. So I think it's impressive. The other thing that caught my eye this week, which I think everyone saw, is the solar eclipse. But really, from like a supply chain perspective, what I found so interesting was I read a story of a company that is like the largest seller of solar eclipse glasses, and their last run was in 2017 during the eclipse then. And this time around, they produced something like, I think it was like 30 million glasses or something. And I looked up the cost. It was like, they can probably get these at scale for under 10 cents. They started preparing for this in 2020. They sell a pack of like six for $10 to $15, it looks like. So a really high margin, but just like, imagine how seasonal that business is, where it's like, okay, every time we have an eclipse, we're going to, you know, build this crazy stockpile of solar eclipse glasses. It was just, I mean, I'm happy someone's selling them because I bought, you know, some glasses, and it was really cool to see, but I just can't imagine the seasonality of running that business. It's insane.
What's also, like, you can't really run a promotion and say, hey, let's have another eclipse this year. It's like, this stuff is literally set in stone. You know, the stars align and there you go. That's too funny. I think that in some ways it's got to be a pretty easy business to predict, because you know where the next eclipse is going to be, you know, roughly, you know, who's going to be interested, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you traveled to see the solar eclipse. You went to Ohio. Tell us about that.
I mean, it is hard to put into words how amazing it was. I mean, I was there with my family. I went up to my parents' house, and we had a whole bunch of people come over, and you know, the actual eclipse itself was so beautiful. I mean, it was kind of emotional too. I mean, just the fact that there are very few times in your life where you recognize this is a once in a lifetime or a two in a lifetime sort of experience. And you can't take a picture of it because, you know, it's still the sun. You can't take a picture of the sun. But I don't know. It was just an amazing moment to be present there with friends and family and my kids and stuff like that. It was awesome. And there were some interesting things where, you know, during the eclipse, obviously you look at it and it's completely blocked out and you're looking at the sun. You can see, you know, red specks coming off of the sun, which were kind of crazy. And just it was so beautiful to look at that. But then you start looking around and you have a 360 degree sunset, which is really weird. And you know, your shadows are, you know, just before and after, you've got one half of your body, like your left side is really sharp and your right side is really fuzzy just with the shadow. And so there's all these just weird things that are happening that were really cool to experience. And, you know, I was looking into, obviously that's been on my mind a lot. We drove back last night. And so we found all the traffic in Ohio, all of the road construction in West Virginia. And I got in about 2 a.m. with my kids. So we luckily them sleeping through most of the ride was clutch. But I was, you know, doing some research and just thinking about the eclipse. And they say this is probably the largest temporary migration in North American history. There are about 4 million people that moved. And, you know, this eclipse generated about $1 to $1.3 billion worth of economic activity. And it wasn't that people came to see, you know, the sun go away for 3 minutes. They went to a new destination. They needed an Airbnb. They needed a hotel. They stayed at restaurants. People want to be entertained. So, you know, if you went to Nashville, you went to Nashville for the weekend. And so there were concerts and there were all these things going on. And so it was really interesting because some of the things I was reading was comparing the 2017 eclipse, which we had, which was another one that, you know, was more rural, went over the Western U.S. And that eclipse kind of caught people by surprise a little bit. Like, I don't feel like it was as well known or publicized. And here with this one, you know, people recognize that there's a business opportunity. And so I feel like for the last certainly couple of months and certainly the last week, it's all you've heard about on social media and elsewhere. And so I don't know. I can go on and on. This is going to become an eclipse podcast. it was just an awesome experience.
Well, you know, what's crazy is that if you compare the migration that happened for the weekend or day in America, that happens every year for Chinese New Year, but like 4 or 5 times that people. So it's like kind of crazy to put it in perspective, but I mean, it sounds like an incredible experience. I mean, you know, it only happens every so often. So really cool to take in and see the, you know, stimulation that it caused in our economy. So that's always cool. But this episode of E-commerce on Tap, we're diving into a kind of, I guess, a hardware company that is fueled by e-commerce, Oura Ring. It has grown like crazy the past few years, but has a really unique and interesting founding story. I think quite a bit different than other e-commerce brands that we've covered in the past on E-commerce on Tap. So Oura Ring, for those that don't know, it's a ring, like a hardware device that goes on your finger and tracks a lot of your health data and statistics. They have their own mobile app. It syncs up, tells you how you slept, your heart rate, you know, how your workout activity is. And I think in general, this is like on trend with what's happening in America in terms of people becoming more conscious, people wanting to track their sleep. But the founding story is super interesting. But before we get into the founding story of Oura, do you want to kind of give us an overview of the industry that Oura rings in, Aaron?
Yeah, and I think generally speaking, we would consider this a wearable technology. Wearables are, just simply put, they're electronic devices that can be accessories. Sometimes they're embedded in clothing. Sometimes they're implanted inside a user's body. Occasionally, they can be tattooed onto the skin. And the whole idea is that you have these gadgets that are part of your attire. So this could be a smartwatch, fitness trackers, things that could be just used in lots of different ways. And so they first got their start in the 1960s, believe it or not, for gambling, for people to cheat in casinos. And so it's a tiny 4-button computer that fit into cloth, and it helped these gamblers kind of figure out roulette and get an edge there. In the 1970s, the first calculator wristwatch was released. I think it was 1975 by Pulsar. And that became a fashion statement. You know, you think about, I think more iconically, Sting from the Police wore a calculator wristwatch. And so that was kind of the first foray of these wearables coming in vogue. In the 80s, Sony released the Walkman. And that was the most popular wearable music device of the period. I think that, you know, a lot of people would wear it, even if they weren't listening to music. You'd have the headphones around your neck. And it just kind of showed who you were and your persona. And, you know, kind of fast forward, you get hearing aids in the 1980s. In the 1990s, you get wireless webcams. In the 2000s, you see just this explosion of wearable tech because of Bluetooth technology. So Fitbits, Nike Plus iPod, the Sport Kit, all those sorts of things. The 2010s, this is really where they would look at as a tipping point for wearable technology. Believe it or not, this is when Google Glass came out. And even though it wasn't quite ready in 2013, it did start to lay the foundation. You had the Apple Watch that came in 2015, And then he had the Oculus Rift in 2016. And now you fast forward to the 2020s, and we've got the Apple Vision Pro and the Humane AI Pen, which is great. Have you played with the Apple Vision Pro yet, by the way? It's pretty cool.
No, not yet. I need to. I definitely need to.
I have an Oculus, which I love, and I've used it probably like 8 times. And then I was just like, I don't have time for this. But I think that the Vision Pro is pretty cool because you can look around and you have like a post-it note on a wall somewhere virtually. And then you can walk around and come back and that post-it would be there. And I immediately was thinking about, man, this is cool, but this is going to completely just change how manufacturing is done. And imagine being a mechanic and having autonomous training, right? Or being able to go in and say, hey, here's the fittings or the inspection points. And just having that, you know, the Vision Pro remember where it is on the machine. I don't know. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I think it's got real world application, you know, blending kind of augmented reality. I think, you know, before with the Oculus, you know, you can't obviously see through the lenses on the Oculus. So it's a lot different. But yeah, I think it's early, but still really, really interesting tech. I think, too, I mean, when it comes to, you know, just where the wearable world is going, it feels like more and more technology here is trying to blend what we do in the real world with technology. You know, obviously there's some use cases with games or you know, more kind of virtual reality. But I think in more cases now, we're seeing wearables really apply to, you know, us in the real world. And I think that's where Aura kind of fits in the grand scheme of the wearable world.
Yeah, completely. And just some statistics based on what you're saying here, 79% of companies who have adopted wearable tech in business say that it's been instrumental to what they're doing. And, you know, those same companies say that, I think 76% say that those wearables improve their performance. And 86% of companies say that they're going to increase their investment in wearables. And so this may be something that business is really leading the way as opposed to consumer tech, which will be an interesting development.
Yeah, super interesting. I mean, and then in the case of Aura, I mean, you know, did they see any of these statistics and that's what led them to say, hey, we need to create this wearable, you know, ring that tracks my sleep? Or kind of what is the background story of the founders? Is it like your typical college dropout story from Silicon Valley? I mean, who are the founders of Aura?
Yeah, no, not quite. this was a company that was a long time in the making. And, you know, all of these founders have a connection to Oulu University in Finland. And they have this shared interest of health and technology. And I don't know if you know your Finnish geography super well, but Oulu is located just south of the Arctic Circle. And so in between Sweden and Finland, there's a gulf. And they're right on the gulf, just almost to the point where Sweden and Finland meet. And it gets so cold up there that in the winter, it freezes over and they drive semi trucks across the Gulf. So they get to save, you know, a couple hundred miles instead of going around on the land, they just drive across. And, you know, in the summer they get 22 hours of daylight because they're so far north. And in the winter though, they get 22 hours of darkness. And so I, you know, I lived in Sweden for a few years. And so this story definitely resonated with me as far as just the Nordics and those sorts of things. But Oulu University is one of the top three universities in Finland. And the reason for that is partially because it's so cold, there's not much to do, but there's lots of R&D talent. And Nokia is located there. They have a huge cluster of tech and just this community piece that's there. And, you know, this Aura is really a story about Finland and Finnish startups as much as it is about American and American startups. And so it's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, so Finland, I guess, only has about like 5.5 million people, but it seems to be like a bit of a hub for tech in this region. Is it because like during the winter, you know, there's not much sunlight, so they just, you know, study and research different wearable technology all day? Or kind of what do you think makes Finland like special in this regard?
You know, I think that there are a lot of aspects about Finnish society that allow them to punch above their weight. The first one is they make sure that everybody serves in the military. And so it is, you know, mandatory service for, I think, 2 years. So you basically graduate high school and then you do the military for a few years and then you go to college. And the interesting thing about that is that the military is a great leveler for them. And so you get these relationships through the shared sacrifice of people from different parts of Finland, people from maybe different economic backgrounds. And so you start to you know, connect each other. And I've heard that this kind of level playing field and making these connections is a huge benefit for not only Finland, but places like Israel or Switzerland, just because you start making these connections that you normally wouldn't have. And so what that does is you start to have these bonds, you start to have these ideas, and you go back to your military days and you think of that. So one part of it is the connections. The other part is that they have a very technical society. They are so into education and learning and, you know, self-sufficiency. And, it's rated as the happiest country in the world for, you know, I think the last 10 or 15 years from the different ways that they look at that. And so it's this interesting piece where you have these connections, you have a technical society, and then because of the way that they've chosen to run their government, they have a lot of basic needs taken care of. There's universal health care, education is free, you don't have that crippling debt that people deal with. And so you have this situation where people connect with one another, and then they have the technical skills to kind of, you know, mess around and find stuff. And then they are in a position where they can go take a risk and maybe not be earning money for student loans because they don't exist, just to kind of do this. So does that make sense, kind of those different aspects of what they have?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most interesting point that, you know, a lot of times sets people back is just in America, we're so used to taking on debt at an early age to go through college or, you know, whatever it may be, and or pay for an unexpected medical bill or whatever comes up in life. And I think what's so interesting about Europe and Finland in particular is, like you said, you know, they're able to take potentially more risk at a younger age because they don't pile up student debt. They don't, you know, pile up, you know, different debt. And I think too, like you said, the mandatory military service enables them to connect across, you know, spectrums and probably teaches a lot of diligence too and processes, which is super important at a young age. What's kind of like the I guess founding story here with Aura? So there's three main founders. Let's kind of talk, I guess, a little bit about who each one of them are. I'm not going to try to pronounce their names because I know I'm going to mess it up. But
I'll do that one. Yeah. So three main founders. You've got Petteri Latala, Markku Koskela, and Kari Kivela. And so there'll be a test on that later. But I think that's the pronunciation. At least that's how I would say it with a Swedish accent. But let's start with Petteri Latala. So he's basically a computer science guy. And from a very young age, he was always interested in hovering around computer technology. And he got a lot of degrees throughout his life. So he got a degree in computer information science. He got a master's in computer engineering and telecommunications. And he did all of this before he was 30. And so a very accomplished guy. And he was basically in school from 1988 to 1999, getting advanced degrees. And he got an EMBA in international business just to add on to the other two degrees that he had. And he was just very educated that way, right? Like this great background. And while he was in school and then after he graduated, he worked for a telecom company called NetHawk. And he started out in sales and marketing. And then he graduated from school, this time for good. And he became the CEO of a Hong Kong entity of NetHawk in 2000. And he was responsible for launching the Japanese and the Chinese operations. So he was promoted out of that role and he became the COO over the entire global company. And he was doing well. I mean, he was, you know, by all intents and purposes, he had a great career, was doing very well. But in 2006, Petteri, you know, decided that he wanted to make a career change. And so he felt that he needed a deeper purpose. He wanted to do something different than just selling networking devices. And so he decided to get into healthcare. And so he ended up taking a job in London and became a VP at a company called Pro Wellness. This was a clinical IT systems company that was really focused on chronic disease management. And that was really his first foray into health and wellness and things like that, despite like some personal interest in the time. And so he did that for a while, and then he moved back to Finland and moved back to Oulu. And he led the Oulu Wellness Institute, and it was like a health spa company. And, you know, he spent about 2 years being a business coach before he started to found Aura in 2012. And so kind of has this meandering career where it seems like for the first 10 years he was going to school and he's like, that's what I'm going to do. And then he took the job that his degrees had pointed him to. I mean, international business, computers, networking, all those sorts of things. And they just decided his passions were elsewhere. And so he kind of had a series of experiences to get into a point where he was in the right headspace to start the company in 2012.
Yeah, I'm going to bet that his experience in Hong Kong helped them when they went to go manufacture, or because, I mean, everyone in supply chain knows manufacturing any sort of wearable is as hard as it gets. And so I am going to bet that they relied on his experience in Hong Kong, or at least some of his connections there, to make sure Oura Ring, you know, didn't have too many challenges in their supply chain that we'll dive into later.
Yeah, that is a very interesting, let's come back to that one because it didn't play out the way that you thought.
And then what about Marku? So he's a physicist, right? So he got his degree in physics in 1996. Spent like 17 years in various roles working and leading imaging sensor type of systems. It looks like he could basically detect like where the human eye sees color of a visible light in mostly three bands, and created kind of like a imaging system to detect that. And the technology was originally used for mining and geology, but you know, now has diverse applications in industries like surveillance. And so it seems like he was kind of more of the physics guy on the team.
He was a very smart guy. I mean, yeah, he just is working on all this really high level tech that gets into looking at different ways to use light. So you think about an Oura Ring and the blinky lights on there. This was his background and what he got to.
Makes sense. And then Kari was an industrial engineer. So he graduated in 1999, spent about 14 years at Nokia, building and designing hardware and, you know, the associated software code with that, held roles as head of operations for a software group and eventually led capacity planning, and left Nokia for Accenture for only 7 months before, you know, he met the other co-founders of Oura. I'm curious, do we know if they all graduated from the Hulu University, or they just got connected through friends later in life?
No, they all have a degree from there. I mean, these are very smart, very well-accomplished people that were really in this epicenter of tech and education. And as you can see, they had long careers for the most part at major companies. I mean, people kind of go to Nokia and they don't really leave. And in this case, you know, we had a couple of people who did. But yeah, it was surprising.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think like led to their decision to join forces and start Oura in 2012? I mean, do you think there was like some sort of spark of creativity? Do you think they were like bored with their careers? I mean, what do you think was like that aha moment?
You know, there's a lot of different ways that they could think about this. I mean, one of it is these are clearly very smart, very bright people. And so they had talked about health and wellness. They talked about wanting to make a difference. And maybe they got kind of bored with just working on switching equipment for the next release of a cell phone. And so I think that there's this piece of hey, I want to make a deeper purpose. I want something that's going to be more applicable to my life. I think the other part too is that they said, look, you know, this has been great. We've been established. Many of them had families. You know, is this what I want the rest of my life to be like? And so maybe there's an element here of wondering, why not me? Could I go do something different? You know, this is it worth leaving this comfortable situation to go do something that could be very difficult? But, you know, I get the sense, I don't really think that they were motivated by, hey, let's become billionaires and you know, do all these things. I think that from what I read, they just had this motivation of, can we fix a problem that is highly technical that nobody else has been able to fix before? But what's your sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think like it seems like they set out and they both kind of all the founders had these independent, you know, theories and goals around like developing a wellness device that was both aesthetically pleasing and functional. And, you know, even if you look at their initial purpose of Oura Ring, it was basically to accurately measure your sleep cycle and compare that data to a person's ability to properly function during the day. And so it's kind of interesting because, you know, having worn and experienced an Aura ring and its app, I think it does accomplish that. And so they set out with that vision, you know, 12 years ago, and it's still doing that today, which is pretty cool. And they have a very like minimalistic Nordic type of look to their design. I mean, their rings are very sleek. You know, it's pretty incredible to see how much technology they pack into these rings. And they wanted to make it more convenient. Like, I think there were a few other kind of early stage sleep tracking type of devices on the market at this time, but nothing nearly as sleek and as convenient as Aura. But, you know, I'm curious, like, to me, it seems like such a unique and interesting problem to go out and solve. I mean, in 2012, there wasn't like this huge kind of wearable health tracking market. I mean, it was early adopter stage, right? And so, I mean, did they take off to the races when they launched, like Merit Beauty that we covered a few episodes ago? And, you know, Merit, like, if you haven't heard that episode, you have to tune in because it's insane. They did $100 million in revenue in 18 months. It's a wild story. But did Aura hit that same stride?
No, short answer is no. They had a very difficult, very technical problem that they were trying to solve. And, you know, they intentionally went after something that didn't exist. And they went after a market that didn't exist. And so it took them about 3 years of prototyping just to do the R&D. And they insisted that whatever they did was had to be technologically superior to what was out there. And it had to hold up to 24/7 use. And so, you know, people didn't want to put a ring on and have to charge it every 4 hours. And so you had to make it last for a while. And, you know, they also felt that, okay, probably the best design aesthetically is going to be a ring. And so that made things really complex. Because you think about, well, you know, the ring has to be snug onto someone's fingers so that the sensors are able to work, but people have different size fingers. And so now you have different size rings. And so instead of making one product, you're now making 8 different products if you've got sizes 6 through 13 like they do. And so it was a very difficult thing. You got to cram all those sensors into a small piece. And so they initially couldn't find really any investors to partner with them at all. And these investors said, look, we don't really see a market in this. I mean, this is the early 2010s, right? This is when, you know, Dollar Shave Club and Harry's and those sorts of things are coming off. There's really nobody interested or nobody talking about a long-lasting device that could monitor sleep. And part of the other problem that they had is that they initially launched their business on their own e-commerce platforms, right? This is still early days of Shopify. And so they made their own shopping cart and decided to go to market with that. And that obviously slowed things down because every time they want to make a change, they had to, you know, change the code base. And then, so they're kind of running a couple of businesses at once.
Imagine if they had pivoted Aura Ring into being just a shopping cart software and competing with Shopify. I mean, that's like the founding story of Shopify there. Toby was trying to sell snowboards online. That would have been pretty funny if they had pivoted into that. But yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of crazy because too, the first iterations of the product, you know, they had a huge base on someone's finger, like about 1 inch long. So it wasn't nearly as sleek as it is today, which I think made it so you really had to be like an early adopter that wanted to track your sleep to, you know, want to buy this. I mean, they priced a single ring at $229, but, you know, to kind of stimulate some marketing efforts, they put on like a sleep retreat in Europe with some well-known sleep doctors. They tried to charge almost $8,000, but didn't really get any takers. So that marketing campaign didn't go so well. And I guess this was after they had launched on Kickstarter to fund development, right? So they launched on Kickstarter. Their you know, first production run was in 2015. They had 2,383 initial backers who pledged $653,000 against $100,000 goal to launch Gen 1. And so that was their campaign, right? I think, number one, it is really cool to see, like, this is kind of the time of Kickstarter campaigns really taking off. You see a lot of campaigns. Like, I think this was also around the same time as Pebble Watches, which was an early wearable device launched on Kickstarter and just go bananas. I mean, I think Pebble did like $5 or $10 million on Kickstarter. It was one of the biggest campaigns at the time. And it was a great way for hardware companies to fund, you know, production and launch. So I think it was very smart at the time for the Aura founders to take this approach on Kickstarter. But Gen 1 only focused on sleep, had a hard plastic looking aesthetic, wasn't like really a jewelry item yet. But it was good enough, and they secured a 1.5 million euro grant from Finnish loans, or from Finnish, you know, kind of, I guess, community government backed programs for startups. And they won a 300,000 euro grant to develop their own analytics platform. So they've got early traction at this stage. They've got some, you know, government funding, which is awesome. I mean, pretty cool to see the Finnish government support a company like Aura in its early stages. I mean, you know, what do you think about their Kickstarter launch? I mean, you know, beating the goal by 650% is amazing. But at the same time, you know, this is also during the Kickstarter craze where you have campaigns like Pebble Watches just going to raise, you know, millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a strong signal for them that this is something they should continue. I think that they reached a little bit, right, with the $8,000 sleep retreat in Europe thing. Probably not the right audience for Kickstarter. But yeah, I mean, it seems like it was their best option. They weren't going to get this built without it. And they needed that, similar to how Liquid Death needed to have the initial video and to show that there were 90,000 people who engaged with it. They needed a Kickstarter to show, like, hey, people say that they want this. People say that they're giving us $200 now in order for them to be in line.
Yeah, and this led to their $5.3 million seed round in 2016, which to me seems like a pretty sizable seed round at the time. I mean, now that's pretty typical for a seed round, but in 2016, like, that was a large, pretty large seed round. And their investors were Joy Ito from the MIT Media Lab Directory and Jan Tallinn, who was Skype's founding engineer. So pretty cool just to see that they're able to pull together this seed round, which seems like it came together because, you know, hey, we sold $653,000 worth of Aura rings on Kickstarter, and they were able to raise money, you know, through that kind of growth, which is awesome. And the business seemed to be doing pretty well in Europe, but was still looking for product market fit. I think Aura, you know, really did struggle to grow in the first few years, mainly due to high price point and a singular focus on sleep tracking. It seemed like, you know, people, number one, weren't as in tune with tracking their sleep as they are today. And people that were also wanted advice to do other things. But the early adopters were, you know, biohackers that were initially attracted to the idea of quantifying and, you know, qualifying their sleep. But, you know, during this time, obviously the major market to enter is America. How do they go about entering the U.S.? Kind of what are next steps for Aura and its expansion?
Yeah, this is a great story. So it's 2016, and Kari Kivilä is in New York, and he's trying to raise capital. So again, this backdrop is the business is kind of working, but it's not, right? And so Kari is at a local Whole Foods, and he's picking up some groceries and some dinner, and he sees someone who's wearing an Aura ring. He's like, oh my gosh, like this is my product, and here I am in New York, and somebody's wearing this. And so this is the first time that he'd seen someone wearing the device outside of the company's headquarters in Finland. And so they know that they have been selling some stuff, but here it is. And as luck would have it, this person was a Wall Street hedge fund manager who had just lost 50 pounds using the Aura ring. So he was a huge fan. And his name was Harpreet Ray. And he decided that, you know what, he's going to invest. You guys are raising money. I have this personal love of this product. Let's do it, right? So he helps raise some money and decides to join the board. Things progress. He eventually becomes president of the company and then eventually CEO in 2017. And just a side with him, he had attended the University of Michigan and he had a finance background. And prior to joining Aura, he was a portfolio manager at a hedge fund in New York, like we said. And so, you know, it kind of seems like this happenstance thing where literally Whole Foods, you see someone, I'm sure that Kari was usually looking at people's ring fingers and just like imagining what was on there. And then he sees that someone's wearing their product. He's like, this is amazing. But you know, a question for I have for you is, as I was thinking about this, is like, I wonder what it was like for these three founders that all had a common history, right? They had a common language. They all lived in the same area. They had struggled for the last 3 years to bring this product to life. And it feels like they just kind of met someone and said, here, be our CEO. And so I'm wondering, like, from your perspective, what motivated them to do that?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems like it's from his background and his ability to try to grow and scale. You know, I don't know exactly what he did within, you know, the hedge fund markets and his investment career, but it seems like he had some experience and could bring together more capital and more kind of marketing expertise to enable him to scale into America. I think the three founders really wanted to see Aura grow. And they saw this as the next step to be a catalyst towards their growth. And I think that's really, you know, what happened, right? Because Harpreet used his investment connections to raise from celebrities like Lance Armstrong, Will Smith, Shaquille O'Neal, YouTube co-founder Steve Chen, Twitch co-founder Kevin Lin. I mean, he seemed to pull together like a great network of investors. And that led to their Series A of $20 million in 2018 that was led by MSD Capital. And so I think this was the right step in hindsight. I think probably at the time it was a super hard decision for these three co-founders to bring in, you know, this external leader. But I think they probably realized, hey, you know, he has a ton of great connections. He can get us into the US market that we really want to expand into. I mean, that's what I think kind of happened when they were making this decision.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I kind of wonder, was this an act of desperation where, again, they've been at this for, they started in 2012, right? And so here it is in 2017, right? They've been at this 5 years. They haven't really had traction. They haven't been able to raise money. And I wonder if there's a part of them that was like, I don't know if this is going to work. So like, why not have this guy over? But I just, you know, I just think about this as like, you know, we both have worked with teams and have team members overseas. And it is hard when you are managing that from a time zone perspective. You're always compromising things like that. But to have literally the entire company in Finland and then to have someone who's in the US, to me, it just seems like it was a really, I don't want to say risky, that's like the wrong move, but it was a bold decision to say, hey, not only do we want to have someone who can be a partner, but you know, why not make him the head of US, right? Or the general manager for the US country. You know, I don't know. It's just, it seems like there was something at play here that, at least to me, I tried to dig in and find some more on.
Yeah, it might've been also, they might've been facing burnout as founders. You know, there could have been a number of reasons, but you know, I think what's really cool is from a product standpoint, you know, they move beyond sleep. So, you know, data that was captured or is captured by Oura Ring expanded beyond sleep to like body temperature, heart rate variability, resting heart rate, sleep stages. They just really enabled people to see more and more data through their Oura Ring. And I think, you know, that was a catalyst to their growth. And they you know, continued to grow. And so that led to a Series B in early 2020 of $28 million. Who knows necessarily if that was signed and done before COVID or after COVID. You know, sometimes companies announce rounds a few months after they actually happen. So
it was actually, I had the exact same question. It was signed like the week that they canceled March Madness. Wow. So it was all in the works and they just decided to do it kind of right there, which was fortuitous timing.
Yeah. So talk about timing. And I think it's interesting too, to see how COVID impacted Aura. Do you want to dive into that in terms of, you know, I mean, to me, it seems like COVID would be a huge catalyst to Aura's growth just because people are so not only scared, but just really conscious about what's happening to their body and wondering, you know, how can I better keep track of these health data points?
Yeah, I mean, COVID was all about the connected fitness craze, which I had a front seat to, but this was a health craze at the same time. And so as the pandemic was spreading, researchers all across the country and across the globe were doing studies about how do you detect or prevent or treat COVID-19. Again, this is early 2020. You know, people are afraid to order Chinese food because they didn't know anything about it, right? There was all sorts of theories that were out there. And people recognized very quickly the potential for a wearable device to provide an early warning detection system for COVID-19 was really interesting, especially to some institutions that needed to remain open. So think hospitals, factories, any of those essential workers. Like if there was a way that they could continue to operate their businesses, but at the same time, not put people at a terrible amount of risk and have an early warning system, that would be very interesting to them. So there were quite a few studies that were done. UCSF, Osher Center for Integrative Health, and the West Virginia University Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute, they partner with Aura. And so I think smartly, Aura raised their hand and said, hey, we're a connected fitness device, or we're a health device, we're wearable. Why don't you use us to do some of these tests? And so the WVU study in particular announced that the Aura was able to predict COVID-19 related symptoms. And so it was kind of just brilliant here, because now they have a independent, right, a third party company that used their product to say, hey, we can help detect COVID-19, in a way that hadn't been done before. Imagine all this data, all these things it can do. And so what this did is really just light a huge fire. And so you think about organizations like the NBA or casinos in Vegas. They wanted to keep their businesses open so badly, and they needed to have it running in a safe manner, or something that appeared to be safe. And so they really latched onto this research, and they started ordering thousands of Aura rings for their employees. And, you know, think about this is like, you know, Caesars is able to say, hey, you know, all of our blackjack dealers are wearing Aura rings, so we know that they're healthy, right? We can tell them who's getting sick and tell them to stay home, those sorts of things. And so you see company after company use this as a way to say, hey, let's just throw money at the problem. And Aura seems to be a great thing. We've got an independent research study that says that, hey, we can do this. And this set them up for $100 million Series C in 2021. And they reportedly sold 500,000 rings in 2021 and over 1 million rings in 2022.
That's insane. I mean, they were definitely on the right side when it comes to growth during COVID. And it's really just amazing to see how they operated during COVID. I mean, they did a lot product-wise too. I mean, it just seems like number one, from a research standpoint, Aura was in the right position to be able to detect or potentially detect COVID early. Number two, they had a lot of big corporate deals going on with, you know, the NBA and different casinos in Las Vegas. And number three, they were doing a lot from a product side. So, I mean, it seems like COVID was a huge catalyst to their growth. I can only imagine what we'll dive into in a bit, their supply chain issues that came up. But I mean, it really seems like right time, right place in terms of their growth. Any takeaways from you in terms of COVID and Aura and how that affected their business?
I think what they did, and whether this was intentional or they just got lucky or both, is they rightly looked and said, hey, I need to have a quote unquote independent body validate the use case for our product. And so they probably funded or funded a large chunk of that West Virginia University study. That'd be my guess. But the fact that they could step back and say, hey, this isn't us saying that we can detect COVID-19. We've got this other company over here that said, you know, clinically we can prove it. That was such a masterstroke of good marketing. And I think, you know, let's suppose they paid $50,000 or $100,000 to help commission that study. I mean, think about the return on that ad spend, right? Like that is enormous. And so I think a lot of times what I see more and more, especially in the connected fitness, wearable, med tech space, is looking out and seeing who's already doing research in these areas that, you know, wants to do things more. And can I help fund that research? And you have to be careful because you don't want them to be like, hey, here's my thing. Can you just write something that says that's awesome? I'm sure that happens to some extent, but the fact that you can see who's already asking these questions and do we have a use case with our products that could solve that issue? I think that more startups should be more tightly engaged into what's going on in the scientific, the academic community to see where they might be able to partner that way.
Yeah, I think that was a huge unlock for them, especially from a corporate angle, that's for sure. And they continue to make product improvements, right? So during COVID, they had Gen 2, which had a lot of really good functions outside of just sleep tracking. But, you know, I think what was interesting, and they probably debated so much on this decision. So during COVID, they had Gen 2, which had a bit more functionality than their original Gen 1. Then they had Gen 3 roll out, and there was a period in time where Gen 2 owners that upgraded to Gen 3 got a lifetime membership for free. But then during Gen 3, they launched a very, at the time, was unpopular subscription plan. So they got, I think, a lot of backlash when they launched that Gen 3 model. But Gen 3 offered, you know, better sensors, nicer finishes, improved battery life. Like, it was an upgrade, but it was also missing a lot of key features that people really wanted, like the ability to measure workout heart levels, blood oxygen levels, and also sleep staging algorithms. So I think, like, I mean, even I hear from my girlfriend that has an Oura Ring, she wishes that her Oura Ring would track her workout levels and her heart levels during her workout. And so I think that's something that, you know, they missed the ball on in terms of, you know, the new product that they have out right now. And then I think when it comes to subscription, I mean, what do you think that debate was? Because before it was a lifetime membership when they sold that ring. And now, you know, you pay monthly, I think it's $5 or $6 per month right now, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things, isn't a whole lot of money. But, you know, hey, if you have a million rings that are being sold, that adds up very quickly and very nicely from a cash flow perspective.
Yeah, I mean, for all intents and purposes, the Gen 3 rollout was bad. It was very, very bad. It was a moderately improved piece of hardware. But the big thing was the fact that you had to have a subscription plan in order to use all the features. And so a lot of the customers were really upset. And, you know, there were comments like, hey, you took away features and made something I had previously purchased worse off by pushing a software update. And it got so bad, like, as you mentioned, some of these Gen 2 owners that had upgraded to a Gen 3 ring within a certain period of time, they were given a lifetime membership for free because it was so bad. And at the end of the day, this rollout, this the overall, you know, burn of the company, things like that, that led to Heartbeat resigning as CEO.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because in 2022, they brought in Tom Hall, which, you know, obviously was a big transition for them. But I mean, what lessons do you think CEOs should take away from this? You know, they're going about rolling out and launching a new product. They're basically changing their pricing model here. I mean, you still pay for the ring, but now you also pay for the subscription, which, like, also it was, I mean, we'll dive into the buying experience there too, but it's an interesting buying experience then, because, you know, you purchase and then every month, you know, you're getting billed by Oura Ring.
Yeah, you know, I think that the lesson here for CEOs is, well, twofold, is I think that people should have seen that this was coming, right? That this backlash was going to be there. The fact that they didn't have a subscription and it was a, you know, free forever sort of scenario to now it suddenly is, there are lots of reasons why they probably had to do that as a business. But they either should have gone into it and said, look, we're going to make a lot of people upset. Let's at least make sure that we've got good customer service and that the hardware is working. And maybe you can work through that, you can spin it. But the fact that this device was basically rushed to market, there were software bugs, it didn't work as well, and then you had this really unpopular thing, that was really a piece where the CEO in this case probably pushed a little bit too hard and you know, should have acted as a brake on the company and say, okay, we're about to do this thing. We know that this particular aspect is going to be unpopular. How do we feel about everything else? Are we good? And, you know, at the end of the day, even though he wasn't responsible for writing any code or doing things like that, the CEO is always ultimately responsible. And so there's a world here where, you know, maybe they were going into it and they said, okay, it's going to be bad and it's time for a CEO transitionary. So we're just going to blame you. Here's some money, go away, sort of thing. But that isn't what happened. And, you know, I think what's really interesting is really the transition that happened with Tom Hale coming in. Because like you said, in 2022, he came in as the CEO to replace Heartbeat, and he's an American, right? He was previously the president of Momentive and the CEO at HomeAway. But by this time in 2022, all of the original founders had left, and the U.S. was the majority of the revenue. And the operational headquarters had shifted from Finland to San Francisco. And so despite being nominally Finnish, Oura had become a U.S. startup. And it was something where you had this kind of scrappy, smaller, niche player in Finland that became an American company and effectively, you know, had all the bad habits of VC funding for connected products during this time period. And so, you know, I just, my question was on my mind as I was looking through this is, do you think that this was a conscious decision, this idea of no longer being Finnish and transitioning to an American company, or do you think it just happened? Do you think I'm just way off on that?
I think it was conscious because Harpeet became a leader that really helped them scale, and he was US-based, right? So, you know, though they stem from Finland, and that's where Oura was really developed, I think at the end of the day, you know, where they really scaled and became who we know Oura as today, you know, that stemmed from the American market and what Harpeet did leading that scale. So I think it was, you know, conscious in terms of their strategy, and they probably saw more growth happening in America, and so they decided to focus on this market.
Yeah, to that extent, though, I mean, like, Nike does a lot of sales in China. Nike is not a Chinese company, right? Like, they still retain that piece of it. They stuck with it, and they've just localized that extent. So, you know, I hear that, like, the center of gravity moved to the U.S., and like, it was important that they had a strong presence here. But it felt like the decision-making or the control, all that stuff shifted. And I don't know if that was entirely the intention or if it just happened. And that's, to me, as I kind of look back in the story, and well, why don't you just take us through the timeline? Because I think some things will make a little more sense.
Yeah. Before I do that, I've got one key question I want to ask, Aaron, is, and I don't know the answer, but do you think, like, I think that 80% of Oura's customers today do not know that it's a Finnish company. What do you think about that?
I think it's probably 99%.
Yeah.
You know, there's something here about, it doesn't have to be IKEA, right? But something that is Nordic has a certain aesthetic. Like, if I say, hey, this cell phone has Nordic technology, you just assume that it's going to be of the highest quality. It's technically superior. It's very good. Where if I say, hey, this technology is, pick a different country, you're like, oh, well, all right. You know, I have a Colombian cell phone. It's probably not a great cell phone. Like, they're not known for that. And so there's a lot that could have been done from a branding perspective and just from an intentionality perspective, say, hey, let's stick with our Finnish roots. Let's be proudly Finnish, right? And like, lean into that. And I don't know if the leadership or the decision-making power was usurped by the U.S. market and the U.S. team, or if that was a conscious decision where they said, hey, you know, we're done here. But to me, that's really the tragedy of Oura, if you want to look at that, is the fact that, at least in my opinion, there was a business that was working. It did need to get into the U.S. And then it seemed like it kind of came off the rails a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was working. But, you know, as we'll see in their timeline, they have struggled to be profitable, right? So 2012 to 2014, they basically spend the majority of their time in R&D, really trying to develop this product. 2015, they go to market on Kickstarter. They have a goal of 100K, end up raising over 600K. 2016, they have a $5.3 million seed round. 2017, they lack traction, but from their early adopters, they have positive reviews. And 2018 is where when they meet, you know, and kind of finalize that deal led by Harpeet that raises their $18 million Series A. And they released Gen 2 and really, you know, went hard into the U.S. market. And in 2018, Oura received the Red Dot Award for its seamless design, which is one of the most prestigious product design competitions in the world. 2019, they reported $30 million in revenue, but with a $1.5 million loss. And that year, they raised a $28 million Series B. And they also won a platinum winner of the Muse Design Awards, winning the best product design. So very design focused, you know, through the years. 2020, $62 million in revenue, but a $2 million loss. And they raised $100 million Series C. And then 2021, they do $105 million in revenue with an $83 million loss. So this is when Gen 3 Ring is released. And I mean, that's a staggering loss during COVID. I mean, do over $100 million in revenue, but lose $83 million. That's pretty crazy, especially when they launched Gen 3, which has that, you know, subscription nature to the product. And 2022, it's estimated they did $120 million in revenue and had a $2.5 billion valuation from a secondary round that they did. And the Gen 3, issues compound. This is when Harpreet departs. And they kind of implement new limited edition partnerships with major brands like Red Bull, the UFC, Real Madrid, and do some kind of celebrity lines with Kim Kardashian, wearing Oura rings. I don't know if that's necessarily paid for or not, but it was cool to see that celebrities wear them. And they also have a limited edition $950 Gucci Oura ring collaboration, which was sold in Gucci retail locations. Last year, they expanded into Best Buy, and this year they expanded into Amazon. So pretty crazy just to see this timeline. I'm curious, have they been able to turn a profit? To me, I think this is like one of those venture scale stories where they grow and burn and grow and burn. And, they really, it seems like they have to right the ship now. So, I'm curious, what are your takeaways? Do you think they're profitable this year? What does that look like?
Well, I just want to step back a little bit more, because I think the key thing here is yeah, they were losing money, right? But in 2020, and I kind of draw a line in my mind with 2020. In 2020, they did $62 million in revenue, and they had a $2 million loss. They had just come off of winning all these awards. And, you're still losing $2 million. I wouldn't want to write that check. But, that is right. You're right there, you're not – the wheels haven't fallen off. And 2020 was the year that Marku and Kari both stepped away from the business. And so you think about these, this is the product engineering guy and the sensor guy, and they just won all these awards, and they decide, hey, we're good, we're out. And I don't know how much of that was, as part of the $100 million they raised, they were able to sell a lot of their shares. And so these cash out said, hey, this is good. I don't know to what extent they kind of knew what was coming, and they said, hey, we don't really want to be a part of this anymore. But, 2020, the first two founders leave. Pateri, who had been the CEO before Harpreet comes on, he steps away in 2021 after they lose $83 million. And so I don't know, there's just this element here where it really feels like the wheels came off the bus right when they should have been growing and doing all these sorts of things. And it was tough. And so, if you just look at where those founders are now, clearly, they're very proud of what they've done at Oura. They set out to make a difference and to do some things in the connected health space. But Pateri, he's a computer scientist. He's president and CEO until 2021. He's now the chairman of a company called Nucra. So he spent, 12 years at Oura, and he left in 2021, and he's now not even on the board. Marku, who is the physicist, he used to be the chief technology specialist, and he's founded another company, it appears to be in stealth mode, called Nodium Innovations. He spent 8 years leading their technology. He left in 2020, and it's what he's doing. And then I think the best one is Kari. So he was the industrial engineer, the one behind all the design, won all the awards. He spent 11 years at Oura, left in 2020, and his LinkedIn just says that he's been on sabbatical ever since. So that means that he did pretty well with selling his shares and is kind of done with those sorts of things. So I don't know. I maybe this is me just having a huge soft spot for Nordics and Nordic countries, but I can't help but to wonder that, had Oura stuck to its finishness and the Finns had still been in charge, if things would have been a little bit different.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good takeaways just based on when the founders left and the losses that continued to amass. I think too, if you look at their product, it is really hard. It's not your standard e-commerce product. Oura isn't just the ring. It's the Oura cloud that allows users to access their data. It's the Oura app, which, has your activity scores, sleep scores, readiness scores. There's a ton of data that is synced into that app. And, having used their app, there is definitely a lot of design and functionality that goes into that to make, an incredible experience. And then they have their Oura membership. So, they don't just have one product. Really, Oura is three or four different products, if you will. It's not just the ring. There's also other parts of the ring. And I think that's, really what makes this business hard. It's not our standard e-commerce company that we usually cover on E-commerce on Tap. They have to do so much more. And I think what's interesting too, what they now have tried to dive into is they've tried to find different ways to monetize their user base that they have. And so do you want to cover kind of some of the other things that they've tried to do, you know, within the Aura ecosystem?
Yeah, absolutely. So they have an API now, so they're allowing people to get at that health data. And so this means that third-party applications and developers can connect to it. And so they're again trying to become a platform. Their biggest growth vector is what they call Aura Business. And so they see corporate wellness as an emerging segment. That market's about $53 billion and expected to grow to about $75 billion by 2030. And the idea here is that this is an enterprise solution that allows companies to share health insights with their employees and the teams. And so you can also get group level insights to figure out like, okay, does so-and-so qualify for better health insurance? This person looks like they need to take a vacation, those sorts of things. And, you know, this is just from a macro perspective, this is a, makes a lot of sense because in 2023, there was a survey of health insurance brokers that said that 64% of their enterprise clients wanted to invest more in employee wellness programs. And so they're trying to figure this out. Honestly, they've had a bit of a stumble now and then. One that comes to mind is that they were trying to build a sense of community with their subscribers. And so they're like, oh, well, let's just create a Slack channel. And so this will, you know, let people know how they're doing and you can kind of share that. And that kind of actually had a backlash from their users because they felt that it blurred the boundaries between the professional and their personal lives. And so they decided to like turn off that Slack integration. But, you know, it's really interesting because there's so many different aspects that they're trying to do. And they've successfully moved from being just a device to now being a platform, a vehicle for getting at what's really important, which is that health data.
Yeah. I think it's cool that they're expanding into, you know, more like, I guess, business use cases. And I do see more and more enterprise companies focused on like employee health benefits. So this is really cool that they could provide them with, you know, an Aura ring and a subscription and all that. As we looked at their supply chain, I mean, I thought it was really cool that their initial factory was located in Finland, close to their main R&D site. And today they still manufacture in Finland and in Estonia. So that's really cool that they still keep those roots there. They don't do too much ocean shipping. They really rely heavily on air freight, which, I mean, their rings are tight, so it makes sense. And from a customer experience standpoint, when you go to Aura and you buy one of their rings, so number one, if you don't know your ring size, they offer a sizing kit, which is kind of cool. So, you know, they send you a kit that you actually have to pay for. So you pay for the kit. But if I remember correctly, that gets refunded or goes into your order if you place a Aura ring order. And so, you know, you first buy the sizing kit, you figure out what size you are. And then you know, go through with your order. So they utilize UPS next day air. You know, I think during COVID, a few people had really complained about wait times of 3 to 4 weeks, which, you know, during that time happened to a lot of different e-commerce brands. So can't complain too much about that.
4 weeks is still pretty good.
Yeah. And I think now they're leveraging, you know, Amazon's MCF, you know, network with their new partnership. But one thing I do want to know about like their logistics and one of the experiences that we had that was pretty funky is like, I originally ordered a ring for my girlfriend as a surprise. And I ordered a color that she didn't want. So we had to like get a different color. And usually you'd be able to just kind of go in and change the color, I would think, or the customer service agent would be able to go change the color. But with Aura Ring and their backend, for whatever reason, they weren't able to just go in and change the color. So they actually had to go refund that initial order. And then I had to go place another order for the color that my girlfriend actually wanted. So I don't quite know how that makes sense necessarily and how they couldn't just like change the color on their back end. But, you know, just a little tidbit from a customer experience standpoint that was a little annoying because I was emailing back and forth with the rep being like, hey, you know, what do you mean I've got to, you know, get a refund and then place a new order for this new color. So interesting experience there, but I did think like their sizing kit was really well done. Shipping experience was great. It was smooth, came really quickly. You know, from a logistics and supply chain standpoint, it seems pretty strong. I mean, it is a light product, so, you know, why not air freight it over like they do? I'm curious. I mean, we've dove in so deep in Aura, given such a strong timeline. To me, I don't quite know like what the future looks like in terms of exit opportunities. What's kind of like your first thought when it comes to like, is Aura going to get bought? Or are you going to IPO? I mean, what do you think that looks like?
Yeah. So they have a lot of things that are working for them. So on the one hand, according to Tom Hale, who again is the current CEO, he says that Aura has like 90% retention year after year, which is phenomenal. And people are wearing the ring, they're using it, they're getting stuff like that. And so they're really moving from just being this device into being more of a health platform. And from that perspective, there's still a lot that they could do. So they could add services around mental health. They could do a lot more with partnerships. You know, I'm waiting for there to be a Peloton partnership comes out. And like that all makes sense. But I think that they still have an enormous amount of headwinds that they're facing. So the first part is like they're not profitable. From what I can see, you know, they've never been profitable, like we talked about. They got close a couple of times, but they're still way upside down. And this is their single biggest issue that they need to solve. There are lots of other competitors or replacements out there for consumers who you know, want to get into the space. So you've got Fitbit, you've got Apple Watch. Those guys keep adding sensors and capabilities. Whoop, which is a smart tracking bracelet. And then actually Samsung is supposed to be releasing basically a clone. The Galaxy Ring is supposed to come out end of 2024, beginning of 2025. And so there's questions here like, okay, you're going to have limited pricing power. You can't just start to charge $1,500 for these things. But you know, when you look at this and you're looking at it purely from an exit point of view, because they're not profitable, their hardware business is essentially worthless, right? They have found a way to lose $20 million a year. Well, I can do that, you know, myself. Like that's easy to do, right? So an acquirer is going to look at this business and say, this thing is losing $20 million a year. And, you know, like that's not helpful for my business, right? I'm better off not doing it. And so an acquirer is going to have to either put in more money into that business to keep it going, or they're going to have to look at some mix of dramatic cost cutting or some future investment to reach some sort of margin accretive equilibrium. And again, this is just break even. This isn't to say, hey, you know, we're making 70% of these things. And so I think that does that make sense so far what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Hardware is extremely hard, and there's only been a handful of exits that are really of scale in the hardware industry.
Yeah. So if we keep thinking about, okay, so we know that if they were to IPO, being unprofitable, like that's not going to work. So really their only option is an acquisition. And so the way that they're going to have to position this is that their enterprise value has to be around their installed customer base. The fact that there are millions of people who are wearing these and that those millions of people are feeding millions more data points on a regular basis, that's really the asset that people are buying. And so they've raised $148 million. They've got a multi-billion dollar valuation. So it's like 16 to 17x revenue. And so that valuation is probably way overheated for just that installed customer base and that data. And so, you know, they would be lucky to get $1 billion would be my thought, but they're probably closer to $400 to $500 million, just from what I'm saying. But the key thing is that they're going to need to find an acquirer who's cash rich and sees value in their data versus the hardware business. And so there's a few companies or types of things that come to mind. So the first one could be like an advertising company. So a Meta or a Google, they're always looking for more information about you, which is their product. And so there's a thought here of like, okay, can I get that health data? Can I combine it and sell more ads? And, you know, Google did acquire Fitbit in 2021 for $2.1 billion. And so like there is an option that's there. You know, it could be another connected device company. And so Apple is the clear one that comes to mind. This kind of looks like it should be an Apple product. But they are going to have to believe that that Aura could be a $20 billion margin accretive business. I mean, Apple Watch did $21 billion last year. I don't think people know, like $21 billion on Apple Watch, which is like, I don't know, I consider it like a second tier product compared to the iPhone. And so again, you're going to have to look at this thing and say, okay, do we think that that's what that can be? And that's a hard view. They may just start over from scratch because the hardware business is kind of useless. Amazon could be interested in something like this, but they recently killed a product that they had a few years ago called the Halo. that was doing roughly the same thing. And so really, you know, in summary, this advertising play, these other connected device companies, this really only becomes an issue or it becomes an option if they become profitable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really good analysis. I mean, I think they've got to make strides to become profitable. You know, it is pretty insane to see the scale of Apple Watch doing 21 billion last year versus, you know, Aura's rings like 120 or 150 million they might do this year. Yeah, it's pretty nuts. I mean, I think it's a good analysis. I think health insurance companies could potentially be an option too. You know, health insurance is all about data and collecting the largest data sets in the world. So Aetna, United Health could decide this would give them more insight into their customers and you know, enable them to give premium breaks and just have more data to better, you know, underwrite their customers. You know, the optimist would say it's like, this would help patients and doctors be more preventative, which I would love to think that's where the market's heading, but who knows? I think it's, you know, a unique story here because, you know, the three original founders are out completely. And it seems like a lot of times when founders step out, the ethos of the company changes. And so I'm curious from your perspective, like how difficult is it right now for Aura to succeed after their founding team leaves? I mean, you gave a really unique insight where when I was sharing the timeline of, hey, you know, their losses really only started to escalate when the founders left. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts around that.
Yeah. You know, I could be completely wrong on all this, right? And so let us know what you think. But I think that in this particular case, that there was something that was lost by growing too quickly, raising so much money, and moving into a market that wasn't their own. So did Aura need to stabilize their presence? Absolutely. Could they have maybe doubled down on Europe a little bit more or taken a more measured approach into Europe? Yes. And so I think that the fact that the founders, it feels like they became founders in name only. They lost decision-making authority. They lost the ability to kind of look through things. And, you know, I get it. Like in the heat of COVID, when you're raising $140 million over a period of 2 years, when you were struggling to raise, you know, $600K a year, you know, a couple of years before, like that's just going to force people to make some pretty brash decisions and to assume that things are there. But it felt like the founders maybe lost their company. And maybe that was a factor of bringing on too many new investors, the business really being operationally headquartered in San Francisco and those sorts of things. So it's a really hard thing to do. And when there is a founder transition, it's always one of these things where like, okay, well, this is now a job for those people. And so how do you get something so that the incentive structure, the compensation structure is one where people behave and act like founders? But I don't know, what do you see in that space?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of it was timing, you know, in terms of burning and growing during COVID, so many businesses were doing that. I think part of it is the business itself. You know, hardware is so hard. There, you know, with Aura, there's really three or four main products here. You know, it's not just the ring, there's the app, the cloud, there's so much more that goes into it. So I think in general, it's just a really hard business to continue to grow and maintain, but they have a very, you know, strong, loyal user base. I would assume, you know, their Gen 4 iteration is going to have a lot more tracking functions and features. But I would assume, you know, it's going to keep that sleek design. I think that's cool that they've kept that in their ethos for the most part. But I mean, this has been like a really fascinating deep dive. I mean, I think my takeaways are number one, you know, probably I still think, yeah, maybe 99% of Aura customers don't know that it's a Finnish company, which is interesting because, you know, a lot of companies really try to lean in and kind of stick to their ethos around that. I think number two, you know, there is kind of a sense of early adopter phase here because now you see so many more people getting into, you know, wearable devices to track their health and wellness. And so I think Aura is going to continue to grow. I think they're going to potentially look for an acquirer, but, you know, have a strong foundation here. And this was, you know, a really great deep dive of you know, Aura on this episode of E-commerce on Tap.
Yeah, I agree. I think a bit of a cautionary tale. They've done a lot of things right as well. I think that if there was probably one thing that might have played things a little bit differently would have been that one of the Fens probably should have moved to the U.S. if that's where the business was being headquartered to, as opposed to trying to run it from afar.
Totally. I agree. Well, this was awesome, Aaron. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this episode of E-Commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcefy and ISBA. Let us know what you think. Aaron and I are both on LinkedIn and Twitter. We're pretty active there. We always like to hear what people think of these episodes of E-Commerce on Tap. Give us a like, share with a friend, and we really appreciate you tuning in to this episode of E-Commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcefy and ISBA.